The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast, our weekly dive into the worlds of media, marketing and commerce. I'm delighted to be joined by our special guest this morning, who is Roscoe Williamson, Global Creative Strategy and Innovation Director at Massive Music and SongTrader. Hello to you, Roscoe.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you joining us. And also joining us is Rachel Smith, our CEO. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi.
Absolutely wonderful to have you joining us as well. We'll dive straight into the world's news stories this week. And the first news story is that Taylor Swift has made a return to TikTok following a royalties dispute between the short-form video giant and her record label Universal Music, which saw TikTok pull Universal's catalogue from its platform. Swift owns the copyright to her own music through a deal struck in 2018, meaning the rest of Universal's catalogue remains unavailable on TikTok. So Roscoe, my first question to you is, how does Taylor Swift's decision to reinstate her music on TikTok impact Universal Music?
Yeah, it's a really interesting move from Taylor Swift, this one. And I guess the big thing is, does this set a precedent for other artists in the future? Are we starting to see a dynamic here, a shift in the kind of power of certain artists and what they can and can't negotiate with their deals? I mean, Taylor Swift has always been incredibly shrewd and innovative with the way she's gone about her music business. And I think this is just another testament to that. But when we think about where Universal and TikTok are at the moment in the midst of this, you know, this quarrel over rights, I don't think it does Universal any particular favors in terms of strengthening their case. Let's put it that way. I think what we've seen here is Taylor going, I've got a new album coming out in a few weeks, and the exposure that I get from this platform far exceeds in terms of benefits, in terms of, you know, potential uptake in live gigs and the monetization from that, than any potential kind of uplift in the negotiation on the kind of streaming rights from the deal. So I think, you know, really she's gone, I can do this, and B, she's gone, the exposure is more important to me. That's, yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because the first thing that I think is really interesting about this story is that obviously she owns the copyright for her music, which puts her in a different position to lots and lots of other artists who are represented by Universal Music and who may well suffer the consequences of no longer being made, listenable on a platform like TikTok. Because as you've rightly pointed out, Roscoe, it provides just such a massive platform of reach, not just for Taylor Swift, but for any other artist that has their music attached to short form videos on the platform. And the other thing I thought that was interesting about this is not just the kind of argument, if you like, between Taylor Swift and TikTok, Universal Music and TikTok, Taylor Swift and Universal Music, if you wanted, but also it's how the world of music discovery is changing. And it's really interesting that TikTok's positioning here is, this is very short-sighted on behalf of Universal Music or any artist that decides they don't want to give us access to their music on our platform, because we provide this free platform for loads of artists to be discoverable. And it took me back to because I am, you know, elderly these days, took me back to my record shop music discovery days. How do people discover music? And it's certainly the case that I too these days discover music via short form videos. You know, short form video pops up somewhere in a social media feed and I think, oh, great tune, what is it? And, you know, I want to, as a music lover, I want to discover music however it arrives on my phone or on a TV screen or in a bar or a restaurant or somewhere. So I kind of understand why TikTok have positioned their side of the argument the way they have. There's a whole other shtick to this, though, isn't there, around royalties, how artists are compensated,
that's it. And I think that, you know, we have to maybe take this whole thing with Taylor Swift as a bit of a pinch of salt, because she is such an anomaly in terms of her like monumental success. And so, you know, will this set a precedent? Does that discoverability benefit en masse all the other artists that Universal look after, or is it particularly keyed into Swift because of her, you know, her reach. And therefore, the argument for negotiating better deals on behalf of all their artists, it may stand up. Do you see what I mean? Even though TikTok are positioning themselves as this discoverability platform, is that true for them, all of the artists that Universal represents? Or is it true for a minority of superstar artists or artists that naturally appeal to the demographic that is the majority on TikTok? Do you see what I mean? So I think that it's very complex, and I can see arguments for both sides. I'm kind of sitting a bit on the fence, but I think here, who is obviously the winner here is Taylor Swift once again.
100%. So she's winning whichever way you look at this, right? And she did that the second that she re-recorded her back catalog, yeah, so that exactly. She would have control over those, over those royalties. And it is interesting because it does sort of take our minds back to, well, you know, I think you're right, Roscoe, from the point of view of someone that consumes music and loves music, it's easy to sit on the fence here because you're like, I kind of want to discover music and listen to music wherever I can. But also, obviously, I want those artists to be paid well. But what it made me think about was that it's drawing all of our attention back to this tussle between, music companies and the artists that they represent and the platforms on which people actually consume that stuff, yes. Those products. Because, you know, that harks back to the days of the late 80s, early 90s where you saw big global artists, yes. Like George Michael, falling out with Sony, trying to sue them because he didn't have enough control over his musical catalogue. We've all heard about the stories of artists that, prolific artists like David Bowie and others who, when they died in the sort of mid-2000s, it turned out had a significant amount of control over their catalogue and, in fact, had sold it as a financial commodity in the financial markets. And, mm-hmm. It draws our attention back to all of that. But you are 100% right. The winner in this story is Taylor Swift.
Do we think, in terms of, will Universal's position in terms of facing off against TikTok change, or will it now be forced to almost stick to its guns even more?
I mean, her positioning sort of undermines their argument to a certain extent, doesn't it? But because she's an anomaly, as Roscoe says, I sort of feel like Universal are going to keep trying to push their desire to renegotiate a better position, because they're going to want to do that not just for their artists but for themselves. That's how they make money too, right?
And I would say they'd be loath to sort of set a precedent and kind of almost, concede on this, because then it doesn't paint her as an anomaly, and therefore other major artists will start to want to follow suit. When it comes to their negotiations coming up, they will also start. So I think there could be a whole knock-on effect. They will try and do everything they can to not happen. So,
Yeah, will be interesting to see how it plays out and whether their positioning does change. But we'll move on to our second news story of the week, and that's that Microsoft is starting to test ads inside the Start menu on Windows 11. The software maker will use the recommended section of the Start menu, which usually shows file recommendations, to suggest apps from the Microsoft Store. So Rachel, my first question to you on this one is, could this be the start of ads populating our devices' built-in features?
I mean, even though I work in the advertising industry, I just want to answer that question by saying I hope not. only because the world doesn't need more intrusive ads. So then the caveat to my answer there is, if it is advertising in a suitable context and in suitable formats, then I think it's inevitable. I can completely understand why Microsoft want to do this. They want to advertise apps that are available to download on Microsoft devices in their app store in exactly the same way that Google does that on all Android devices, that Apple does that on all iPhones and on all laptops that we use. I think the key thing here, though, is what that advertising looks like, where it's placed, and what that does to the user experience. Personally, if I'm on a Windows device, that would typically be a laptop, and I kind of don't want. I certainly don't want dynamic ads getting in the way of what I'm trying to do, because when I'm on a laptop, I'm mostly working. Yes, I'm doing maybe a little bit of streaming or a little bit of internet browsing, but typically a lot of that happens on other devices for me personally, and I can't imagine I'm unusual. So I just don't want it to be. I don't want it to be a poor quality, even if I think about the Google Play Store, because I'm an Android user, like, it's fine, but it's a bit annoying. You've got slightly dynamic ads, and it's just, and it just gives you this low value vibe, which is not, I know, what those hardware providers want. So I think that, whilst I can understand why Microsoft want to do this, and of course they're going to use the hardware that they've got in front of people to create an advertising opportunity, just make sure you do it in a format that's not irritating.
The big thing here is this, like, you know how the start of kind of automated vehicles, right? And there's this kind of phased deployment thing where they get a little buggy and they deliver pizzas around, right? And it gets everyone kind of familiar with it. Oh, it's a nice, cute little buggy delivering pizzas. And eventually, you know, in the future, we've got automated juggernauts, right? If you kind of like parallel that to what's going here with the kind of gradual invasion of potentially like in-product advertising, yeah, fine. It's a, you know, it's a one password pop-up at the moment in the Discover section or whatever it might be. But I mean, what does this lead to over time as they slowly, you know, seep into this world that we pay for, you know? And I think that's the kind of worry. And you know, it is a trade-off between user experience and monetization. It also poses the question about potentially Microsoft's innovation strategy at large. It's like, why rely on this form of monetization, you know? How's AI going? Surely that's not, is that not making them enough money? I mean, it's kind of like, it's an interesting one to kind of go, is this really that important to them? So, yeah, I think there's a few things here, but ultimately it's got to boil down to the user experience. But I fear that people will just get more comfortable with it, and then there may be just different tierings of the software, just like we've started to see with, for example, Amazon Prime come out with, you know, different tierings of Prime. Suddenly it's like, oh, okay, now I have to pay for the completely ad-free version. Maybe we'll start to see this more within operating systems. But yeah, I would hope that something like Apple would never follow suit. I don't know. Let's see.
Well, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? Because, it, you know, your choice of language there was really interesting as well, Roscoe. Like, you know, is this a suitable alternative for Microsoft in terms of advertising and what's happening with product innovation? It feels as though it's kind of the saloon of last resort. You know, it's not actually the best option for them. They're resorting to using whatever real estate they've got on their hardware devices to push advertising, to make money through their app store, and to, I suppose, potentially enter the realm of competing with their peers. But that doesn't, it's not where, you know, it doesn't feel as a consumer that's where they should be competing with them. They should be rather innovating around other products and around other things to be making money. And, you know, Windows is not it's not a cheap software package, right?
No.
So, you know, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what else they could be doing, not just with tiers of, because you can also obviously use Windows as a software package now on a subscription basis rather than an annual license fee. Mm. So there's lots of different things that they could be playing around with there, and lots of different things they could be doing to the Windows software products that kind of compel people to pay in specific ways. And yeah, I just, you know, like I said, the world doesn't need more low quality advertising. The other thing I think as well is that I think we've all seen what happens in a marketplace where you are just totally bombarded with advertising. You absolutely, in the end, tune out. So more ads does not equal better results for anyone involved. And I think the last thing you want is a, you know, US TV style environment where there's just so much advertising that no one's listening to any of it and people are just tuning out doing other things until they can skip the ads, you know, whatever that might look like in a sort of laptop desktop environment.
I did read a counter argument from somebody who was kind of very pro it, in terms of talking about actually how hard it is to understand the kind of wider system of what Microsoft has to offer in terms of their, you know, products and apps, and actually being served up stuff that is suitable and that person needed was actually quite useful. So again, it's all down to how it's done, but it's going through beta testing at the moment, isn't it? 11, and I guess it's down to the feedback of those users as to whether or not they pursue with this as a strategy or not. But it feels like it's coming. They've been doing it for a while. I heard that at some point they were doing it with the File Explorer, and which would be really invasive. I mean, imagine that, just going searching for your files, and at the top there's an advert there. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, change your monitor setting, sponsored by Electrolux. It's not really the kind of user experience people want. But I think you raised that question earlier in terms of that trade-off between user experience and in terms of, you know, users tolerate ads you know, more widely on free services, you know, or where there's a significant discount. Obviously, you know, the likes of Google, Facebook, they've built themselves off being a free service. Rachel, you raised that point earlier. It's like 120 quid for, you know, Windows as it currently is, and users just aren't going to tolerate that. And there's also a new story out today that Roku has a patent out, basically, which enables them on their TV devices to show ads on any other device that's plugged into it. So say if you've got a games console plugged into your Roku TV, Roku can then show ads over that device. And that to me just seems very, very overzealous. And I think while advertising can be, you know, extremely profitable, there has to be that balance struck.
I definitely think so, because I just think that, well, I just think exactly as I said earlier, more doesn't equal better, right? I think the key thing here is about quality, relevance. You know, the example that you just provided there, Roscoe, of the counter argument, that's all about relevance, right? Like if actually you are being targeted with messages about something that will be specifically useful to you, then that's a different matter. Quite frankly, in the advertising and marketing technology industry, that's what the whole industry is preoccupied with, the idea of getting relevant messages to people in the the least intrusive way possible. And surely that's what brands want too. So, you know, you just hope that rather than altruistically everybody heading in the right direction, what you want is there to be an economic imperative for everyone to head in the right direction. And that gets back to, again, the point you raised earlier again as well, Roscoe, around what are they doing around product innovation. So there's got to be a balance here. And definitely heading towards a world where people are bombarded with ads at every corner isn't the world I don't think any of us want to live in.
No, we don't want that, no.
Matt doesn't want to be bothered by Roku ads when he's gaming.
Absolutely not. I'm more of a desktop user anyway, but you know that can now be disturbed by Windows. I think also one final point on that is that, you know, obviously, you know, in the world of ad tech at the moment, attention is such a big thing. How much attention is going to be paid to these small little ads within the example shown of the file recommendations? It's not really like you're going to be paying attention to that. You're going to want to be ticking on the file you wanted to look at in the first place. So I reckon that's something.
The reach is undeniably vast. I mean, when you think about the reach of it, So I think that's the kind of lure.
That's clearly what's tempting them, right? Yeah. But I think they need to refine the idea a bit. Let's see what the beta testing.
Let's see what it kicks up. But yes, hopefully we won't have scenarios as described earlier as device settings and having to change your microphone, you know, only to read a sponsored message that you can't click through. But anyway, we'll see how that develops, and we'll move on to our final news story of the week, and that's that for the first time ITV is considering allowing political parties to buy ad space on its ITVX streaming platform ahead of the upcoming general election in the UK. The ban of political ads on TV currently only applies to linear. So Roscoe, my first question to you on this one is this a positive move for UK media?
Is it a positive move for UK media? Well, I don't think ITVX have actually decided, have they? They're sort of contemplating.
Yeah, they're mulling it over, I think.
Mulling it over. And why might they be mulling it over? Well, because of the huge monetization possibilities, right? We know that, I think, Gove, a couple of years ago, upped the possible budgets for these campaigns like more than double or something. And I think it's up to 36 million or something at the moment. And a vast amount of that could, in theory, be spent on this kind of advertising. When you couple that with the decline in kind of traditional linear revenues that I know ITV are facing, and then the uptake in users in ITVX, it doesn't take rocket science to kind of go, okay, there's an amazing, very tempting monetization opportunity here. You know, I guess alongside that, is there an argument that you might reach a kind of more disengaged audience through these channels, younger perhaps, that are desperately kind of maybe in need of a bit more education potentially on politics? But then it opens up the whole debate of if we open up this door and do we start to go down the track of a kind of more Americanized world where we get to kind of, you know, monetization is key when it comes to kind of political, right? So, Yeah, again, I'm probably veering more on the conservative side of this, not the political party, but my views in terms of I don't think it's a great thing. But if they don't do it, YouTube is just going to get all the money. Let's face it. So yeah,
it's a bit of a scenario where I feel like the legislation needs to be kept right up to date with this, right? So they need to make a choice from a legislative point of view about where they will allow political advertising. We know obviously that's what the crux of this story is that currently there isn't anything to ban it from being shown on video streaming platforms or TV streaming platforms. But I feel as though legislators are going to want to really update that piece of legislation, even if it's to say, okay, yes, we formally sanction it. It is okay to enable it on that platform, because they'll want to do that, because the debate, I feel, is going to kick up immediately as soon as we start to get into full swing election mode, as soon as an election is announced. There's a few things going on here, right? From a political point of view, never mind a media point of view, which is that the cap of whatever it is, 35, 36 million, is significant. And you're absolutely right, Roscoe. From a media point of view, I just think I think it will make it difficult for broadcasters who have got credible streaming solutions or good audiences there. It'll make it really difficult for them to back away from it and to resist it, because it's going to be extra budgets and they're all going to want a slice of that budget, and they're certainly not going to want to stand by and see it go to streaming platforms or social media platforms and not get a share of it. But then on the other hand comes the moral, you know, enter the moral argument. Well, which political parties are going to be able to raise that 35 million to dedicate? You know, it's certainly only going to be the major two political parties. One's probably going to find it a little more easy than the other, but maybe not. You know, maybe I'm casting aspersions. But certainly other political parties, smaller, more independent political parties, will not have the same share of budget. Therefore, they won't have the same share of voice. There will need to be some tight regulations around what this video and TV advertising, political style advertising, looks like, because we haven't had it here before in the UK. So they're going to need to really quick, smart, get to grips with what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and what kind of tagging they need to add to it effectively. So, you know, in Australia, we have political advertising on television and have always had, but there's very strict rules around it. So basically they're terribly boring ads usually, and they come with a 10-second super speedy verbal explanation afterwards, a bit like the American political ads probably do too. But they probably serve the purpose of getting a political party's messages out there, or at least some of their messages out there via a medium that speaks to the broadest audience possible. So I understand there's a place for them. However, my other counterpoint here is, in Australia, like nowhere else in the world, it is compulsory to vote. I feel much more comfortable about political advertising being sanctioned and controlled and available across all mainstream media in an environment where everyone is forced to go to the polls. I know that whole, voting being compulsory is contentious, and it's not about to be introduced probably anywhere else in the world anytime soon, but it does rebalance things. Here in the UK, you're right, Roscoe, young people are a lot of young people are really disengaged from politics. We're in desperate need of trying to get some messaging out there that engages them, trying to communicate with them in a way that is really picking up on the issues that matter to them. And if it means that we could be catching them on other platforms where you're likely to find them, that's great. It's just a case of who's catching them and who's actually going to be affording to get those ads out there.
Yeah. And I guess let me just pose kind of wider questions in the potential decline of linear TV viewership. And even within older generations now, I think the statistics show for platforms like ITVX that is now increasing. And so therefore, in terms of getting that messaging out, maybe there does need to be a reevaluation of the law. But as you said, it would have to be done very, very tightly controlled. I think it then opens up the question about, other kind of private channels, platforms, MyFi, for example, would they follow suit? I mean, I know that all four, Channel 4's kind of strictly said, no, we're never going to play there. But, again, what might happen? Is it going to set
budgets? Exactly. Yeah. And once budgets start rolling around, you never know. The other thing is, I do feel there needs to be, imagine this for a second. Imagine TV political advertising, or let's say on streaming platforms, not on linear, on any other platform that you use to consume TV, because it's becoming so complex these days, right? Like some people watch, the streaming platforms on YouTube, so it's like you double platforming there. So wherever you're consuming your TV that isn't linear, imagine you're seeing political adverts, and that is a bit new. But you actually have an explanation of who is representing themselves in that advert, and that it is an advert. And then you balance that out against those bill posters that were broadly, used during the Brexit campaign in 2016 on the sides of buses, on digital out-of-home billboards, where you're just whizzing past on a bus or you're walking past, even if there is a disclaimer at the bottom, which I'm sure there had to be, you weren't reading it, you didn't see it, you didn't know the context, you didn't understand who was putting the messaging out there. I sort of feel better about the TV version because I think you're getting better, more transparent information. Then it just comes down to who's got the budget, what are the appropriate budget settings, and what are the constraints around this that make it as transparent and fair as possible.
Yeah, it's amazing that they haven't updated the law since 2003. Like, think how much media consumption habits have changed over the course of that time. Videos were still the, we still had a video player, we're still playing videos. Like, it's ridiculous how, pre-smartphone, pre-social media, and the fact that it hasn't been updated. I know there was attempts to update it in 2013, but the fact it, hasn't really been updated since 2003 is really shocking to me.
It will be interesting to see the spread of media and how the parties go about it. Because, there's other platforms that are out, even podcasting, for example, could be potential.
Absolutely.
And I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see how they go about it this year. They'll be going for it 100%,
Absolutely. And I think also too, this is going to be that turning point, right? This is going to be, I think, this general election that is coming up in the next 12 months or so, less than. It's got to be called before January 2025, right?
I think, end of January 2025.
So really, it's likely to be called potentially any day now, because you've got to expect they don't want to go to the polls in the middle of winter. So, I know the last election voting was in December, but I think the beginning of December is very different to the beginning of January. Yep. So you've got to imagine they're going to announce it sometime soon. I think this election is going to be really different, right? We are in a world that is post, linear TV, even if we are still consuming linear, it really is the post-linear age now. We're also in a post sort of Cambridge Analytica scandal age as well, where there's much more controls around what you can spend on social media platforms and how. There are loads of challenger platforms, loads of other environments in which people can be spending their media budgets. So I think this, and there is this matter of having a greater potential cap put on your total media spend and being able to potentially reach streaming platforms. I just think it's going to be really interesting times.
Quite telling that 2 days after this article came out on ITV News, there's an article saying Conservatives' loss of support amongst young people is ticking time bomb for party. It's kind of interesting, that then maybe this is a sign of actually kind of justification for, at least to the Conservative Party, for why they may want to be doing this in the future. But we will see.
We will.
Yeah, we definitely will. And anything to bring up voter engagement can be a good thing. But how they strike the balance going forward will be really interesting to see. But that draws us out of time for today. But Roscoe, it's been absolutely brilliant. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks, guys.
And Rachel, thanks as ever.
Pleasure. Was delightful.
Absolutely. And thank you all ever so much for listening to this week's MagTech podcast.